Welcome to the Critical Ecologies podcast series, which is a series of interviews with master's or postgraduate level students in the Department of Geography in Maynooth. So these are students that are taking a module in spatial justice. So some of the students are coming from other departments. So in this case, we have this morning Roisin Reddy, who is doing the master's in environmental psychology, or is it an MSc in environmental psychology?
MSc, yeah.
MSc in environmental psychology, which is just, you're the first cohort. So we're really happy to have you. And you've been a great addition to the class this year. So I guess we could just start with you saying a little bit about yourself and, you know, where you come from and how you got into environmental psychology and how you got into the topic, which the topic of your essay, which is spatial and environmental justice, with a particular focus on Leitrim.
Thanks. So I originally got into environmental psychology because I was looking for kind of an alternative route at looking at how people interact with their environments. I came originally from a nursing degree, so I kind of looked into, I was interested to see how, mainly how workplace environments affect people and their mental health and the resilience that people have to continue working in such high stress situations. But I've completely done a flip on the areas that I've been looking into, and I think it's only natural that I've kind of landed in the more justice side of things, because for a long time I've had I've been incredibly interested in the idea of how and where people are situated and the way that that impacts their living experience. One of the things I think that has shaped me and that put me pushed me towards picking this module in particular was back in secondary school, I went on a volunteer trip to South Africa, and we did a few we went to Johannesburg and Mozambique, and we got to work with a lot of people in squatter camps, and it was such an eye opener for me. In how people can be so similar, and you can have so many things happening that are so similar, but that they're living in such different situations and such squalor in this case, simply because of where they were born. And I think, you know, when I got to see what this module was about, I think it just, It was just one of those things that I was like, oh, that's a bit of me. So I think that's why I particularly wanted to focus on the spatial and environmental justice aspect. Like, I couldn't really choose any other concepts particularly that I could focus in on, because I think it's just such a large concept in general that it's impossible to hone in on one particular part.
Well, thanks. It's always nice to hear the background, and it was really beautifully put. But you mentioned there spatial and environmental justice, so maybe, I mean, they are very big, you know, more than concepts, they're kind of fields, I guess. So maybe you could do your best at trying to briefly explain what spatial justice is, what environmental justice is, and then particularly how they intersect.
Yeah, absolutely. So so I guess the thing that the best way I've found to describe spatial justice to anybody that wants to listen to me is who gets what and where, and like how this incredibly complex concept is very much looking at the unequal systems that are in place and the spatial reasoning around why these manifest in certain areas. As we've repeatedly used SOJA in our 2009 in our lectures, you know, I think it is incredibly important to recognize how they say that you know, we can see the injustices happening. It's just it's the question of why, and why they're happening where they're happening. I think something I mentioned as well in my essay was the importance of recognizing the perceptions of space as well, which is something that has definitely my opinions or my perceptions of space and the value of space and how it's perceived have completely altered since beginning this module. And I think that's a big part of probably what spatial justice is. And then I guess environmental justice is a similar approach in the way that it looks at people's experience of environmental injustice in specific communities populations of people. Kind of, so for example, like energy poverty, transport poverty, pollution, climate change, and the policies that are put in place to kind of interact these things and how they affect people in certain communities, more than likely marginalized communities. And something that I used quite often was the DCU environmental justice report that DCU researchers kind of captured some of the key dimensions of environmental and climate justice and the experience of vulnerable and marginalized people. And I think something that was interesting that we discussed was the fact that even though it captures quite a lot of the experiences of people who are living in communities that are suffering from environmental injustice, it was interesting to notice how little of the spatial aspect that was actually captured within that report. For example, some of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about with Leitrim, the more issues on extractivism and the concept of wastelands and the more rural aspects of Ireland and how they're being affected by a lot of the spatial injustice issues that are happening.
Yeah. No, I think that you explained those really well, and I think that point about how certain approaches to, you know, dominant approaches to environmental justice, and it's not that it's incorrect, but that the emphasis tends to be on marginalized communities, whether they're racialized, whether they're it's to do with class, whether it's to do with ethnicity, and that's all well and proper, but that the benefit of linking or connecting environmental justice with spatial justice is it broadens it.
Exactly,
it shows that there are other forms of environmental injustice that can't easily be understood just in terms of class or just in terms of race or just in terms of gender or ethnicity.
Precisely, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly important, I mean, globally, but in Ireland, where we see these kind of peripheral or semi-peripheral geographies and how they've been subject to certain kinds of industrial and extractive you know, activity, I think it becomes all the more important. Yeah. So anyway, I just talk less. Well, you've mentioned already this idea of perceptions of space. So I was wondering, because I think it's a really interesting point that you raise in your essay, and about how these perceptions of space have a role to play, or a central role to play, in kind of unequal distribution of resources or uneven patterns of development. So I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about that and give an example.
Absolutely. So I guess when I'm talking about like perception, I think it's interesting, something that I've come to notice specifically is, you know, even just the idea of borders is such a human creation. It's a it's something that like geography doesn't really take into consideration. So that's kind of one of those it's one of the things that like these our perceptions of how a place or an area is completely developed within a societal framework. And I guess one of the main perceptions or concepts that would grasp this, I think, would very much be the idea of wastelands and how value is put on land. So with the idea of wastelands, which like originates from colonial times in Ireland in the 1600s, and then it's interesting to see that like this idea of like putting value on land and having it a certain perspective of how land is and the value that's placed on that land, I do think stems back from kind of when Ireland was colonized in the 1600s, and the idea of wastelands has a big impact on how we view the productivity of land. So how you know, how much resource can we get from land, and what profit can be gained from land. When I think we've seen within this module specifically, when we got to talk to Kate Flood and looking at her her work with Gurley Bog, it's you know, the value doesn't necessarily always land in profit or in what can be garnered or what can be used from the land, but also how we use the land. So you know, how the heritage that's involved, the history, but also the biodiversity and the different species that are living in an area, for example, like a bog or the wetlands, which is, I think, the perfect example of the, you know, the idea of wastelands and how they're treated. And I think, you know, it as I said, it's stemming back from colonialism. You know, it was the idea that like the land wasn't being used to cultivate profit or to cultivate resources in a way that was seen to be useful, or it was then seen as wasteful land. And I think it's interesting to look at it from that point of view, because really, if we were to consider things in that way, if we were to consider everything other than just land in that way, it would put a very different perspective on how we perceive anything, even like people, you know. it's one of those things, I think, that it's very much stemming from my background with psychology, where I'm like, to have such a strong idea about something, to have to label it in such a way that it's wasteful, creates this idea that there's like a justification there to do something with it, when in all actual fact, that might be a quite a negative way of perceiving something.
Yeah, and I guess at a very basic level, you know, because we looked at wastelands and the idea of waste and value, you know, that those terms are full of all sets of values and assumptions and norms and you know, mm-hmm. ideological sort of, you know, assumptions, ways yes. of seeing the world. And I think even that is an important takeaway, that whenever we hear those words, waste or value, that we have to understand that there are other ways of thinking about that space or the kinds of activities that happen in those spaces. Mm-hmm. It's not a kind of a neutral universal category. Mm. So I think that is very helpful, and I think, as you say, it's a good way of getting at this question of how perceptions of space matter. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I guess we could turn to look a bit more at the empirical focus of your essay, which was Leitrim, and using that to kind of elaborate on spatial and environmental justice and why they're important for trying to understand what's happening in a place like Leitrim. So maybe you could just give a bit of a basic description or overview of some of the spatial and environmental justice issues or sort of challenges that Leitrim has been experiencing in the last number of years, and maybe a bit about how communities who live there have responded.
Yeah, absolutely. So County Leitrim, I've had the privilege to visit before, but we've also been there on our trip with this module. But it's a beautiful green landscape. It's a bordered county, six other counties surrounding it. It's the smallest population or county in Ireland. And I think it's only makes sense to begin talking about the incident of fracking that occurred there, and how they were under threat of the use of hydraulic fracturing in 2010. And hydraulic fracturing is to extract gas and oil from shale rock. Basically, it's the process of extracting those resources. And I guess like it's important to understand that like the reasoning for on a governmental point of view for allowing for this to occur would be to I guess ensure Ireland's independence having security for energy and not relying on importing from other areas. But I guess at the time in 2010, when Leitrim came under threat of fracking happening in the county, there was also a lot of news coming from the state, from the United States, about the impacts, the environmental impacts, and the community of Leitrim came together. There's Love Leitrim was established, which is a community-based organization to campaign against the fracking happening there. And there's a lot of different impacts that could be seen happening in the United States, I'm completely just
all right, it's a lot to cover.
I know. I just feel like I've like not said anything that makes any sense at all in the last 5 minutes.
It all makes sense. I think there's a lot to cover with the Leitrim, you know, the various campaigns. So
yeah,
you could probably say less about them.
Okay, you know? Yeah, correct. With the fracking, Love Leitrim worked for 6 years. They campaigned and they were able to basically bring in an anti-fracking ban for the Republic of Ireland, which is a great success story. However, that's not the only thing that Leitrim have had to really fight against. There's also seeing a lot of afforestation happening in the county, with again a lot of major impacts that on the community due to the fact that there was a forestry scheme set up initially, and it was for farmers to avail of so that they could have forestry plantations within their farms. But this was opened up, and now bigger organizations have been able to take advantage of this. So there's a lot more competition with land ownership, and there's a lot of afforestation of monoculture of trees, of the Sitka spruce conifer trees that are being planted very densely together. And, you know, people are feeling like their homes are being isolated from the community, and it's having major impact on the community itself. I think it's interesting to note as well that like a lot of the trees that are being felled are also being brought to other counties, to other sawmills, and it's not necessarily something that is fulfilling the needs or the resources of the community either. Another of the issues that they're also facing, or sorry, Save Leitrim are actually another organization group that are working to kind of in opposition of the afforestation, and they're also looking into the proposed sites for wind farms that are already existing in Leitrim. They already have wind farms there, but there are plans for more, and the proposed sites are actually wetlands that for new windmills that are being put in, and there's a lot of concern within the community that there's going to be that they're going to cause landslides, and there's the other environmental justice issues that come with I guess green energy that they're also pulling in as a resource to kind of oppose the wind farms. And the newest threat I think that Leitrim are fighting now is the threat of gold and silver prospecting in the county, which there have been licenses already granted to allow for prospecting in the area. Treasure Leitrim are a group that are now opposing, and they exist of a lot of the previous members of Love Leitrim. So it's interesting to see that they've gathered again and that they're fighting a similar battle. But I think that's the reason why we're talking about them, is because like there's so many things are happening in one area, that is bordered by six other counties that don't seem to be fighting the same battles. And I guess spatial justice would ask, why this place? There's I think a lot of the answers I would say for the why have a lot to do with these complex issues and phenomena that continue to reoccur, like with extractivism, which is the practice of both the extraction of resources from the land, but also like it's rooted within the like economic growth and capitalist system that relies on like the consumption of goods and the exportation of goods that are being extracted from one place, but usually cause local disposition, or the local community are not gaining from this extraction, which I think can be seen if when the fracking was an issue, if that had have occurred, thankfully it didn't, but if that had have occurred, that would have been a good example of extractivism. And now with this new issue of the gold and silver mining, it definitely would come under that, which again falls back to our history with being colonized, and how the land is perceived, and how the land isn't being used, let's extract the resources that we can get from there, and allow it to be distributed.
I I was just going to interrupt you there to say something about that this is, there's a longer history is what you're getting at.
That's what I'm getting at, yes.
Yeah, that these are four relatively recent campaigns that are in the last, you mean fracking was 2010 was the campaign started. So it's 15 years. There's a lot of different things in 15 years, less than.
Absolutely.
But as you're saying, that these kinds of logics of extractivism in relation to Leitrim has a much longer history, where resources were taken, you know, the local population was not, you know, there wasn't investments in their development and social infrastructures and,
you know,
whether it was housing or, you know, ways of improving the land or anything like that, has a much longer history. And obviously that's complicated because it's different kinds of phases.
Absolutely.
You know, but
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has definitely to do with like the idea of rural as well, you know, the concept of like somewhere being rural and marginalized and like as you said, with you know, it, none of the no investment being put into the development of an area and how that can continue to underdevelop an area. And that lasting history is still playing its part today.
Yeah. And I think that there's an interesting point, which you can see with the wind farms, particularly maybe, well, the Sitka spruce actually too.
Yeah.
And the gold mining, is that you actually do have investment in the area, but it's investment for the extraction of resources and profit ultimately.
Absolutely.
So it's not investment in the place for the place or for the people. And I think that that's an important distinction to make, because that's a lot of what gets to the heart of their grievances and their frustrations and their sort of sense of injustice, which is that there is money coming in, but it's investment in infrastructures and projects which are to benefit those private developers and, you know, potentially consumers of those resources elsewhere. So I think, I think that it's a really important, why, you know, what you're unpacking here around spatial and environmental justice, is that we need to understand the deep sort of histories and layers to that, if we are to make sense of the resistance and the objections, and not, you know, not just dismiss them, or not, you know, to not fully understand where they're coming from. But maybe building from that and getting towards the end, you mentioned Hilary Tovey's work in your essay, which I was really pleased to see. She was my PhD supervisor, and really great sociologist who did a lot of work on, I guess, in the 90s, especially early 90s, there was a lot of kind of rural, you know, community-based or grassroots-based campaigns or opposition to industrial developments, to infrastructure projects, to extraction of fossil fuels in Shelter Sea, for example. And she came up with this kind of typology or distinction between two different kinds of environmentalism in Ireland. So I was wondering, because you talk about it in the essay, could you briefly maybe summarize her argument and maybe say something about why it might be useful for thinking about opposition to so-called green projects today?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. So Tovey, I really enjoyed reading her work, actually. And it made a lot of sense, I think, in how to bridge a gap, I guess, that we're looking at in I guess, research and activism. So her concept or her idea around environmentalism in Ireland is that there are kind of two elements, two sides or two movements in it, and that there is the official movement, which kind of consists involving around kind of conservation of heritage and environment, and usually consists of, you know, people who may be working within or an organization with this sole cause or of environmentalism or activism, and that, you know, they may be coming from an education of middle class privilege. And I think she uses the words knowledge production, that they're in the field of knowledge production or education. And then the populist environmentalism, which is the community-based local movements that are usually organized or led by people who are speaking for a community and generally would kind of consist of rural areas. I think she I like the way she brings up the fact that you know, the idea of both areas could of both areas combining their efforts could actually lead to some conflict, but at the same time there in the 90s anyway, there was a lot of really the official of environmentalists weren't very really recognizing the populist environmental movement, and that was creating a gap of knowledge, because there, you know, there's the knowledge of policy and legislation and how these bigger concepts work within this system, but also there's the ground level knowledge of the lived experience and how that impacts on the people who are mostly who are feeling the impact the most. And it kind of gives it that more qualitative feeling the value of space, like we've spoken about, and how it's more than just there for that a place is more than just what it can produce. And Toby talks about the interlinking of both environmental movements and how the insight of the official environmentalists, how you know, they could assist in the policy and legislation side, because I think something that has come up a few times with the organizations, the community based organizations, is that the more official the more official side of the activism can be quite difficult to access because of the way it's been set up and the barriers that come in place, just due to the access that they have. But then that the populist environmentalists can lend their voices to the action and really help to develop arguments that need to be heard when it comes to this these kind of movements, in order to lend a more lived experience to the action.
Yeah, and I think the fracking ban is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Where Love Leitrim were obviously rooted in Leitrim and the community there and the place and a kind of protection of place, but they linked up with other groups around Ireland because fracking.
Yes.
There was prospecting for fracking in other parts like Clare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they joined up with, you know, representatives of the Green Party, for example, mm-hmm. environmental NGOs. And it was ultimately through, you know, that work and that coalition that they got the law changed for the ban on fracking. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, I know we don't have much time, but how do you see what's happening now in Leitrim advance this argument of Tovey's, or say, you know, in what ways might Hilary Tovey's argument need to be kind of modified? I say that in the context that a lot of the projects, except for fracking, but the forestry, the wind farms, even the gold mining to an extent, are being somewhat justified in terms of a green transition. We need gold as a for green technologies, green gold and silver. We need wind energy for decarbonization. We need forestry for biodiversity, for carbon sequestration, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not only that these projects are being opposed by local community, say in Leitrim, it's that these projects are being pushed sometimes as green projects. So to what extent maybe does that change things? Or, you know, if you don't have anything to say, because I didn't plan this.
Yeah, question. No, I think it's interesting because I think that there are arguments to be made for and against green infrastructure, and like I guess there is a lot of greenwashing happening, in which like we're being like the general public is kind of being sold on green infrastructure, and there are a lot of arguments for and against, and I guess having, I think Tovey's idea of having the need to combine both the kind of the, for example, us as academics, you know, if we can lend our platform to the people of that are in these situations, and to be able to, I guess, condense these concepts and to put forward the knowledge of that we have with the arguments that we have to for and against green infrastructure, it might just lend a little bit more of a, or illuminate the more realistic the reality of the situation, and that, like, you know, because it's being sold at the moment that like green is good, but there are a lot of implications there that are not necessarily positive. And I think by shining a light on that, it might just bring things up to a more even level, by, you know, to allowing people to kind of, I guess, make up their own mind about it instead of just kind of selling it. I think could assist in different perspectives coming into the conversation, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a very good answer. And I think, you know, you made the point already, which I think is important, is that for Hilary Tovey, these two types of environmentalism or kinds of environmentalism are not necessarily opposed.
Yeah.
That they're kind of in parallel, and mm-hmm. there's blind spots, and sometimes they are in opposition.
Yeah.
But there are ways, or there should be, you know, we should try to find ways of maybe not just bridging them, but of trying to avoid a kind of a polarization,
yes,
of these kinds of environmentalism, and falling, yes, into a trap of like, you're either for wind energy or against wind energy, and it's like, well, actually, you know,
exactly.
No, we need wind energy, but we need to develop it in a different way.
Precisely.
So yeah, I think you're spot on there. So I don't know if, because it just bleeds into the final question, which is about what some of your main takeaways are from your research. And you know, you've already made that point about the role that I think academics engaged in this kind of work, you know, how important that work can be or should be. But is
Absolutely.
There anything else, you know, it could be about research you want to do after the master's, or it could be about, you know, how you carry this through into your own daily life, kinds of things you might get invested in or involved in, or, you know, I'll leave it open. Leave it open to you.
Yeah, I think a very good example is some of the guest speakers that we got to hear from over the course of this module. Some of the work that they've been doing was incredibly inspirational to me. Very much what I've always kind of strived to do is to recognize my privilege and to kind of, I guess, be able to lend that privilege, or that the platform that I've been given as somebody who's, you know, a middle class white woman, and hopefully be able to lend that platform to other people, because if anything, this module has just amplified my opinion that it is so necessary for those who go unheard to be heard, especially in the case of trying to get to the root of a lot of these injustices, whether it be spatial, environmental, social, you know, it is incredibly important that we that all aspects are considered when decisions are being making on policy levels, and that that there's a voice to be heard from all aspects of life at the table.
Great, that's really wonderfully put, Roisin. Thanks so much, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us and your research. And I'm really excited to see where what you do next. And obviously, we'll be staying in touch. So thanks a million.
Thank you so much.